So it's a pleasure to talk here at home, and thank you for the opportunity. There have been a talk of Andy Strominger 3 months ago in this workshop, but many of you were not here, so I will try to review a little bit the Curl CFT, the core of the subject. But I want to try to also keep my audience for the people that were here in that talk. So I will not do it the same way. So I will start by making a connection with 3D gravity. And it's really the inspiration. The inspiration comes from that, because all the results in semi-classical analysis have been done in 3D gravity. And the same ideas appear in Curl CFT. So I think a lot of the conceptual issues that appear here already are present in 3 dimensions. So I will start with that. And I will try to go to more general correspondence. That's it's more recent work. So, but I will try to keep it a review for everybody also. So, well, it's impossible to do everything. So let me start. 3 dimensions. So I will look at antecedent space. So antecedent space as a length scale. D given by L. I will write down these coordinates. And I think Melanie used sine hyperbolic rho, something like that. Okay. And this antecedent space-time is a solution of a pretty general action. So let me write down something general. It can be any higher order derivative terms. So this action can basically depend on the metric, the Ricci tensor, and the Riemann tensor is entirely determined in terms of the Ricci tensor of the metric, but you can also have derivatives of this, etc. Plus matter. So these general theories are just parameterized by the coupling, the Newton constant, and also by a lot of parameters depending on what kind of higher derivative terms you put. So it can be, if it's TMG, it's this value mu that was described before. Can be a lot of different parameters. And until you see the space-time is generically a solution to these theories. If you, it's a constant curvature space, so the Ricci is determined in terms of the thing is minus 3 over L squared. So if you write down the equation of motion, you will basically write down L in terms of the different parameters of the Lagrangian. If it admits, well, if it's a solution, it's not, well, sometimes you have just flat space or the Decider space, but if it admits anti Decider space, the length scale will just be determined in terms of the parameter of your Lagrangian. Now, what I will call semi-classical analysis is when this length scale is bigger than the coupling G3. So this would be my working definition of what I mean by semi-classical analysis. And what can we say about all these theories of gravity that admit antecedent space-time in this limit, in this range of parameters? So this action appears, for example, in string theory when you have different brains and you can look at the effective action close to the horizon, and you have an LS3 factor with a lot of different things that you can Kaluza-Klein reduce to 3 dimensions. So this is a relevant action. And also just if you look at Einstein gravity or TMG, this is a relevant action. So I will not make a distinction between the two. So what has been explained is antidecider admits a conformal boundary. Because you have R squared here, so at infinity you have a cylinder, and you can define left and right moving modes, different morphisms, given in terms of x plus and minus. are given by some modes like this. We call that epsilon, we call that L. And the same for L bar in terms of X minus. So these asymptotic symmetries extend the exact symmetry group, which is SL2R cos SL2R. And what you can show, well, what has been shown by Born and O in ancient gravity, but in fact you can try to do that for any kind of theory, you can write down boundary condition. So you can write down a space of solutions to these theories, which obeys some particular Frolov condition, and maybe some condition, some different differential equation on these matrix, so that you define a space that will be of interest for you. And that space has to obey certain properties. So all you want to have this Virasoro algebra realized on that space. So you want that all the charges, let me call them big with curly n. So may I explain a little bit how to compute these charges? There is always a way for any theory to write down an explicit formula for these charges. And you want them to be, so these are the charges associated to the Ln and to the solution G. And you want all this to be finite, conserves, so independent of time, and well-defined. Well-defined mean that for any solution, you have a unique answer. If you have a phase space of different solutions, well, I will not spend too much time on that. You want to associate a unique quantity to each of them, which is what you really want, right? So writing down these boundary condition is depends on the theory. There is no universal way of doing it. Depends on the theory, because writing down the condition of finiteness, conservation, and so on really depends on the way, the precise Lagrangian you are, because these charges depend on the explicit Lagrangian that you consider. So, but there is always a way to define this, at least a phase space. And then the observation is that if you define a Poisson bracket between these charges, that it can be defined that way. So this Poisson bracket, I have to define what it is. So on this charge, I will act. I will derive inside of them the metric and replace it by the Li derivative associated to Lm. So that's the definition. You will see how the charges change under this different morphism.
Can I ask you, so when yes. you try to construct different boundary conditions, so the only constraints you have are the ones that you know about for the charges?
So there are these ones, and also you want that the phase space you consider, if you want to have two Virasoro algebras as asymptotic symmetries, you want the phase space to be preserved by the action of these Virasoro algebras. So you want that the Li derivative of the metric will obey these Frolov conditions, and I think that's it. There is some technicalities, but these are the main conditions. So the remarkable thing so this algebra is realized in that way. So realized means that I didn't mention, but well, probably you know that these generators Ln, they form a so-called the width algebra. So if you look at the Li bracket between these two vector fields, they obey this property. The same thing for the L and bar. And they commute between each other. So this these brackets will represent the charge in the sense it will provide an isomorphism between this algebra, this Lie bracket algebra, and an algebra defined in the theory, defined on your dynamical space of these conserved charges. And so there is the same algebra for the Ln bars, with a central charge that we called, let me call that one C left and C right. So it's really in three dimensions, everything has been worked out for finding what these central charges are. And it's a result by Saida and Soda that this, you are familiar in Einstein gravity, the central charges are equal, and they are given by the antithesis radius L and the Newton's constant. And if you have any action, the central charge gets modified. And they get modified because the antithesis radius will now be a function of this theory. But there is a second modification. It will be multiplied by some factor that you can determine, that is a constant on the antithesis, and determine in terms of the derivative of the action with respect to the Ricci tensor. So here, if this is a diffeomorphic invariant theory, the left and right are equal. So this is only for diffeomorphic invariant theory. Now, you are completely right that in TMG it's not a diffeomorphic invariant theory. So I don't know if the central charge will be computed in complete generality if you have everything, but if you're in TMG, the left and right are shifted, and the difference between the left and right is related to the diffeomorphism anomaly. Mm-hmm. So I will rewrite. And indeed, they are shifted differently because of this anomaly. Yes?
Do you consider diffeomorphisms that go to the identity at infinity?
Yes.
I mean, is there still a problem? I mean, the transalignment search integrated should be diffeomorphism invariant.
Is diffeomorphism invariant up to boundary terms? And these boundary terms show up. So you can think of the central charge as saying how the action also is not invariant under conformal rescaling of the boundary metric. And this difference between these two central charges, you can think of it as saying how the boundary action is not invariant under diffeomorphism, or if you work in the Wilbite formalism, under local Lorentz transformations. So it's pretty neat result, but what does it mean? So before explaining what it means, I will introduce two more concepts. Well, you're familiar with the BTZ black hole, and if you compute for the BTZ black hole the charge L0, which is curly L0, in Einstein gravity you are familiar that it's given by the difference between M and LJ, and if you compute it in higher derivative, I will, for this discussion, I will keep. Let me assume diffeomorphism invariant for the moment. And the other charge is given by this. And what is the entropy of the black hole? Well, in Einstein gravity, you know it's the area divided by 4g. But for a given theory, the formula has been worked out by Wald and Iyer, and is given by some function L of the action. So in any dimension is given by that, it reduces to a simpler expression in three dimensions, but let me just write it just once. This is the entropy of the black hole. So you have two very different computations. So if you have the entropy of this black hole, how do you get it? So you get it using the first law. You get it because you know in the first law, you got the variation of the energy given by the temperature times delta S. And the temperature is something which is geometric, which you don't need to know the theory to compute T. You need to study free quantum fields in your geometry, and you know what is t. The energy is defined with respect to the theory. It's a very complicated function of the Lagrangian. And so is the entropy. And you identify the precise coefficient by matching it with the first law. Now, the central charges, you obtain them by an asymptotic analysis. So you obtain them by realizing in a phase space these asymptotic symmetry generators. But the precise value also is a precise, in fact it depends only on anti-Decibel space and the Lagrangian. So the only input that you need to compute these quantities is the action and the fact that you are on the anti-Decibel space. Right, so now the interesting point. And that's, I think that's the main result of this semi-classical analysis, is that you can write the entropy like this, right? So for all cases that are known in these general theories, you can always write down the BTZ entropy in that way. And what it means, well,
Are those script L's?
Yes, they're script L's. Sure. Thanks. So this formula is a Kardy formula for a CFT. Whose central charge are C left and C right. In the state where you have L0 and L0 bar, as eigenvalues, and these you can compute them classically. So now comes the question: what does it mean? So this is usually interpreted, and that was the point of Andrew Strominger in 98, that he realized that after having computed this microscopically the entropy of the D-brains. But you realize that this entropy of the D-brains finally contains also this derivation. So you can reduce the new horizon geometry of the D-brain in using an effective action. And at the end, you apply also the Kardy formula with the right central and left and right central charge that you can compute microscopically. So this is a general argument that what you want to say is that this asymptotic analysis tells you that quantum gravity, if it admits anti-Decibel space, should contain states that form representation of these two Virasoro algebra, and that this matching tells you that there is some microscopic counting in a CFT that will reproduce this entropy. We know about when we actually try to quantize the theory and try to find a quantum gravity. Well, in string theory, there are many effective actions like that. And if you try to truncate the sector and just get Einstein gravity, it seems, so as many explained, it's not clear if this theory can be quantized or not. In TMG, there is a conjecture that parallel gravity can be quantized. Because there is some good signs that it can work. The partition function has been computed and has some nice property. But it seems that this matching of Kardy with the Kardy formula works in all cases. So does it mean that this matching will imply that all these theories can be quantized? Probably not. There are only a few of these theories that can be quantized. So this argument, the semi-classical analysis, tell you already give you some indication, but it's more general than the number of theories that actually could be quantized. Probably.
Jeffrey.
Yes.
This Kardy formula, you check case by case, or you can get a general derivation for a generic Lagrangian like you wrote?
Up to now, you check case by case, because the problem is to write um, Wait a minute. So for, if you have any diffeomorphic invariant theory, you have this entropy, this formula of entropy. So if you, you know you obey the first law, you know actually about the second law, that one, but at least obey the first law of thermodynamics. You can derive in general for any diffeomorphic invariant theory. But if you have TMG, it's not diffeomorphic invariant, there is no, some formula just for TMG, for the entropy, but there is no generalized formula. And for the central charges, these arguments were also given in general for the diffeomorphic invariant theory by these two people, Cross and Larson and Wilkins. So in that case, anti De Sitter space, you have that. But there are many cases where you are not an anti De Sitter space, like you have these warp geometries that we try to talk about. And because the boundary conditions are different, the algebra that you get are a bit different, and well, it's not as worked out. But there is probably a general argument. Yeah. So, well, the main lessons I wanted to draw from that picture is that the Kali formula works in all cases for all these theories, and it doesn't tell so much about the CFT. Just tell that if there is a CFT, then it has these two central charges. And also, the main interest for the moment is this for trying to quantize explicitly the theory is chiral gravity, and the phase space that is defined for chiral gravity basically contains only the BTZ black holes and the Virasoro descendant of them and trivial diffeomorphism. So this phase space, this set of solutions that we'll try to quantize, contains very few things. It doesn't contain the degree of freedom of TMG that you throw out. So it seems that it's a nice setup to have a phase space which is very restrictive and do not contain local degrees of freedom. It's easier to quantize.
How do you tell when a theory can't be quantized?
What could go wrong? Many things could go wrong, I guess. The constraints in the quantum theory are far. Not all classical theories can be quantized. For example, you expect this length scale to be quantized because you expect that the central. So, for example, the central charge. In this example of chiral gravity, the central charge of 24 will be some level k that should belong to the integer numbers for the theory to make sense. So if you choose L to be anything else, it doesn't work. So this kind of argument, well, there are many of them for consistency.
The gravity was that like repetition function, one that makes sense.
Yes. Well, if indeed. Well, if you. I'm not a real specialist of that, but then.
But when you say the partition function doesn't make sense, you mean what's the sentence that you look for?
Oh, say you don't have a Maurerian partition function.
You don't have one.
Yeah, if you try to sum, to write down the partition function just using the BTZ metric and its Virasoro descendant, and you guess, you apply a lot of regularization, and you try to get what the partition function of the torus, you go in the Klein space, and you sum over all possible geometries inside of these, fixing the conformal structure of the torus, and you try to write down the partition function just by summing all the possible real saddle points in instant gravity, you don't find the modular invariant answer. So, and the outcome, well, seems to be that in chiral gravity it works. Let me now go to the second part of the talk, our additional question on the first part. So, CFT. Let me start with the motivation. So, experimental black holes, I will try to motivate the following sentence, but tell me if I am convincing.
Well,
So it's just impossible with that. That the same are nearly physical, but I'm not really physical. So so in theory, you know that in four dimensions, well, for the usual Kerr black hole, the angular momentum has to be less than one, otherwise you want to have a next singularity. And there is no physical process that can bring the angular momentum to reach the bound and to go beyond that. So and if you try to add particles, the black hole will spin and you will not be able to add more angular momentum than mass to the black hole. And you can say a bit more. So that was analysis by Tone. So if you take into account the details of the radiation of the matter around the black hole, it will be a constraint to put more stuff in it. And you can compute some bounds on that, and you get that number. And what is interesting, so that's the theory. Any astrophysics? You can find a black hole, and his name is GRS 19+101. So this is the one. And it's not possible to compute the mass precisely. So the mass is between 10 and 15 solar masses. However, you can compute the ratio J over M squared with great accuracy because it's related to the radius of the innermost stable orbit. And I don't know exactly how they do that, but once you know the innermost stable orbit, it emits some redshift, and you can compute that length, and you derive the ratio. So for experimental black holes, I'm not physical, right? But I'm not too far. So I will study only extremal black holes because that's only there that we can see something. And the hope is that it will tell something about astrophysical black holes. And if not, well, that's a good. That will be. We will learn a lot of things about extremal black holes anyway. So do you remember the Kerr metric? It's far more complicated than
when you say you're going to use the Kerr CFT to learn something about, you know, near extremal black holes, I mean, what's an example of something that you want to calculate using this?
Personally, you mean? I don't know. So what Hartmann and Andy Strominger are trying to do is to compute the gray body factors and relate these gray body factors with the two-point function of the dual CFT. But I don't know if it's really something that you can that you can find the data. I'm not convinced. But so the Kerr metric, well, two parameters, and asymptotically flat, I will write them in these coordinates t, r, theta, and phi. If I begin to write it down, I will take 10 minutes, so maybe I will not. I guess you are quite familiar. And I will do the extremal limit, so I will send j to m squared. So some characteristic of this metric in that limit. Notice that the entropy is given by 2 pi times the angular momentum. And the angular velocity, so the Kerr metric has an ergosphere, observers close to the horizon are co-moving with some velocity compared to infinity, and the angular velocity is given by this. Another 2m. So once we have this metric, what I want to do is to zoom close to the horizon. So I will write down new coordinates. So let me, I will explain the physics behind that. So I want to look close to the black hole horizon. So what I will do is to take the radius close to M, where M is the unique horizon, the inner and the outer horizon coincides. It's an extremal black hole. And I will send lambda going to 0. So I will be infinitesimally close to the horizon. And at the same time, I will shift time. And I will co-rotate with the black hole. So I will co-rotate with the black hole. That's what it means. So before writing down what you obtain, let me show you one picture. So if you write down the Penrose diagram, that's pretty useful. Oh. So here is KITP. And here is the black hole horizon. So this is GRS 19, well, nearly hit, right? Not exactly, because there is only one horizon. And what I will do is zoom in that region. So the near horizon region is really this region. And you send the parameters, you will send that region really close to the horizon. So this boundary is time-like, so you can just do a conformal transformation and rewrite it that way. That's the equivalent way. And this really looks like ADS2 space, where it be with these two boundaries. So now with that introduction, let me write down the metric. And the metric is very simple. So it contains indeed an ADS2 factor. And this is the entire metric. So B and C and K are some functions.
Need a factor of B in front of your theta squared.
No, I can always. Okay, so this theta I will call, well, let me call a new theta. I will call that C of theta. And I will rescale theta so that this one. So these are the tilde quantity that I untilde. And I can always do that. So that I just have three functions. And this quantity I just, so in fact k is 1 for Kerr, but I put it in that form because in any theory, any extremal black hole will have a new horizon geometry with that form. And that's a quite powerful statement. So why is it true? This metric has an enhanced symmetry. So you see, because of that factor, there is really an ADS2 factor contained in it. So this symmetry is in fact invariant under SL2R cross U1, where SL2R comes from the symmetry of this factor, and there is an extra d phi over here. And it's quite unexpected, right? Because you start with a Kerr metric, which has only two symmetries, and you get some space-time, which are as four. And you can show that if you have any black hole for any Lagrangian, which has the inner and outer horizon, which coincide, around that horizon, there will be an enhanced symmetry. And then you can write down what the metric look like using that symmetry, and you will find that result. So it was done by Kondouri, Lucetti. And this one was found by Vardin and Gary, I should mention. Of course. And Riyad. So, and there is also an extra symmetry that I would like to mention, inherited from the black hole, which is the T phi reversal invariance. And these two symmetries will play an extremely important role. So now there is a nice setup. I don't know if I So these geometries, I will just mention the connection to 3D gravity. So you find these Lacroix are not extremely asymptotically to ADS3, that they do not contain the ADS3 factor. So the analysis will be a bit different from what we have learned in three dimensions. But it contains geometries that are closely related to ADS3. And these geometries, if you forget about theta for a moment, you just cancel that term. B becomes a constant and C another constant. These geometries are the so-called warp ADS geometries. Well, if you want, I can explain more. I don't know if I want to spend time on that, but basically, if you have two SL2Rs in ADS3, the left and right, you see ADS3 as a group manifold. There is a choosing a killing vector of this SL2R, you can define a new metric, the warp ADS metric, by adding to the metric on Ramsey the theta space the combination of these vectors. And if you do that, you will break that sector, you will keep SL2R, and you will have different metrics that can be classified. So there is a nice interplay between 3D and 4D. And maybe I will not discuss too much about it. But for the expert, these metrics are space-like warp anti the theta space-times.
Is this dimensionally dependent, or can this be extended to any dimension?
Let me mention that it can be extended to any dimension. So, and let me answer your question. So you can, so this part will be the same. This time and R and the theta will be the same. But now, for example, in five dimensions, you have two orthogonal planes of rotation. So S3 has a theta and two phis. And the metric will look like the two first factors, dt, dr, and d theta, and the other one will be given by this. Where these functions depend on theta. And you can define for each orthogonal plane of rotation a different value of k. So in this case, for five dimensions, you will get k1 and k2. And you will get the SL2R will be extended to SL2R equals u1 L, where L is the number of independent planes of rotation. Yes?
What's this parameter k in your metric?
For the curve spacetime is just one. So, but if you have any theory, you know that the metric will be given by this, and k is some fixed number. So for k anti the theta spacetime, for example, it's some function of the length scale and of the angular momentum of your theory, or your black hole. I try to keep things general, to keep the general properties. All this was geometry. Now let's talk about the curl CFT, what it is. So I need two ingredients. The first ingredient is to study free contour fields. In the curl geometry. So if you study free quantum fields in a curved geometry, what you find is, and I will, let's start with the non-extremal black hole. You need a curve, an extremal curve. You find that the fields live in an ensemble weighted by some Boltzmann factor, which is as a fixed temperature given by the Hawking. They can say Hawking temperature and some angular velocity. So what you do is you decompose your free scalar field, let's say, in terms of modes with a given energy and angular momentum, and you decompose on the sphere, and you write down, decompose your mode like this. With respect to the T and phi, which are the T and phi asymptotically, so this T and this phi, the one that are, the code, the asymptotically flat coordinates. And if you quantize these fields, you have to choose with respect to what time you quantize them. So and then you have some problems, because in Kerr there is no global time function. Because you have either, if you have d over dt, the asymptotic time, there is an ergosphere, where d over dt becomes space-like. So what you can do is to quantize using the time defined close to the horizon. So you will use the vector d over dt plus omega d phi. And so this is the generator of the horizon, which is null on the horizon. And if you write down the ergosphere, actually, it will be time-like in some region around the black hole, and become space-like outside. So you quantize the field with respect to that vector, and this is what you get. And now, what I want to do is, I will do two limits, the extrema limit, and the limit close to the horizon. So if we do the limit, you first have to transform to express the quantities in terms of quantities close to the near horizon geometry. So what you do is you re-express these modes as an expansion around the rescaled, let me call that Ni and R. The rescaled variables, where this t and t tilde I obtain in this fashion. So you define this nl and r, and then you rewrite this factor as in terms of nl and nr, and you define what you mean by these two quantities, tl and tr. And you take the extrema limit. So you put, now you impose that j is m squared. And what you find is that only remaining factor is 1 over t, some function times j, where j was this original j, where tf is 1 over 2 pi for the curl geometry. And if you do the algebra in general, it's 1 over 2 pi k. So with that argument, what you want to say is that even though the Bekenstein-Hawking temperature vanishes for the extremal curl black hole, the fields are not the field are still at some temperature around the horizon. They are not pure states. And there is an associated temperature or chemical potential associated to that, given by 1 over 2 pi or 1 over 2 pi k, because you find this Boltzmann factor for this distribution. And j is the original j, is the momentum of these fields associated to d over d phi. So it's like if you had modes that would ring around the d over d phi direction. This d over d phi is important. That's the one that appears here. Right. So now comes the second argument. Was it clear? Okay. And the second argument now is that you want to realize, you want to study the asymptotics in these spacetimes. So in this IDS2, you want to find now, and that's as we knew from this lesson of three-dimensional gravity, we want to define the phase space, so define boundary condition for the metric, such that all charges are well defined. We do it finite, conserved, and well defined. And what you will require also, so you want to extend, you want to have this, at least these symmetries as asymptotic symmetries of your space. But in fact, it doesn't seem to work that fine. So what you want to, what you really want to do, is to impose that the charge associated to d over dt is exactly zero. So we want to keep the extremality. And if you keep extremality, you can define a consistent phase space. And this phase space will also contain a Virasoro algebra. So if we contain a Virasoro algebra, because for the set that you write down in that way, which extends, in fact, the U1 factor. So U1, this U1, the same U1 that physically, well, that's the one that you want to consider, because the if you see this temperature and if you see these modes, you want to say that there's something non-trivial in that sector. So you can write down the only condition that are invariant under this Virasoro algebra, and all charges are well-defined, and they form a Poisson bracket, which is given by a Virasoro algebra. Well, where the central charge is given by for kerr is given by 12j. So for that to make sense, I mean, you want to consider a sector with fixed angular momentum. You don't want the central charge to be a fixed quantity for your black hole. And that's the second point, that you have you can define the safe space with this central charge. And before going on, let me tell you an anecdote about this Virasoro, because I learned from Roman Jakif, when he was at the conference, its 3D workshop, and told us that Virasoro algebra, in fact, was found by a postdoc of Virasoro when he was at MIT, and this postdoc was also a climber. So unfortunately, he died during that summer. But he sent his computation to Virasoro, and Virasoro didn't believe that because there was an anomalous term in his computation. But after that postdoc, Joe Wise, I think. After the summer, Virasoro finally redid it, and it was correct, so he published it under his name. So in the honor of all postdocs, I will call that Virasoro Wise algebra. All right, so my main point, what, not that one? But, yeah, Joe Wise. The main point now, well, you guess, no? So the black hole entropy, I told you it was this area, what was it? Was it 12? No, 2pi. 2pi j. And quite magically, you can write it down, not at that one. I will write it down another way. You can write it down like this. Where C is the central charge, 12J, and F is this Frolov Thorn vacuum. By the way, yes, this was studied by Frolov and Thorn. So there is only one parameter to fit, and that parameter fits. Right. So maybe it's not too surprising. Well, it's just one parameter. And this formula is the formula for, it's another version of the Cardy formula when you have a CFT at a fixed temperature. And so what you want to say is that there is a, it's an indication and a hint that there is a CFT at that temperature that describes the microstates of the extremal black hole. So since it was only one parameter to fit, people have tried to increase the number of tests, and that number is amazing. So you can you have in fact 20 references try to match. And it seems that for any extremal black hole it works. So you can each time write down a formula for the Bacon chain Hawking entropy. So you remember, so if you have any theory with matter, the entropy will still be given by the area divided by 4g. If you have a higher derivative correction, you have this Wald formula. And if you try to find the temperature, so to find for any black hole, you can play this algebra, and it will not really depend on your theory. It's just free fields in the real curve geometry. So whatever are the dynamical degrees of freedom that give you this metric, what is really important and what the metric is. So basically, this argument runs true for any theory that you want to consider. So any extremal black hole will have this a temperature, and if you look at the details of the, you need to know the details of these formulas that depends on the, if you have Kerr in antinosita space-time, for example, this formula will change a little bit. So this temperature will change a little bit, and the only change is that you have this K that is coming. Yes?
You mean to say only for rotating black holes in various spacetimes?
Yes, only rotating black holes. So, so if you have the Kerr Newman black hole, for example, with oscillatory charge, what will happen is that the Sanford charge here, when the J goes to zero, will degenerate, it becomes zero, and at the same time, the temperature will become infinite. So, in that limit, somehow, if you want to interpret that in terms of CFT, the CFT description will break down, and you would need another description. And there is another one that has been proposed later on, it's the next paper of Strominger, where they look at the Virasoro algebra, which also is contained in the gauge fields. And somehow the gauge fields becomes important to describe the entropy.
So you're saying this doesn't hold for pure extremal Reissner Nordstrom?
Yes, it doesn't hold because the description breaks down. This C becomes zero and this T becomes infinite. So technically, there's something, there is a limit that you have to take, and so nothing is really well defined. So you have to suppose that the angular momentum is non-zero.
So for Kerr Newman, do you change the Boltzmann weighting so you have the angular momentum potential and the chemical potential for the charge? Or
yes, that's true. That's a good way of putting it. I don't know yeah, that's true. That you should look at fields that are charged under the I cannot reproduce all the argument here, but yeah.
So for those general statements you made, about the symmetries, that only applies for Kerr type geometry. Applies for Kerr type geometries. There has to be.
It has to be an extremal black hole. So it applies also for the Reissner Nordstrom.
So that's for any extremal.
Yes.
This thermodynamic argument won't carry through unless it's got rotation.
That's right. So what exactly go wrong? So indeed, there is an extra term here, and somehow let's see. So when you compute these central charges, also, well, the matter usually do not contribute, but let me just say that for the non-rotating case, this is a bad idea to look at this Virasoro algebra. And it's a bad idea to construct this phase space, because it does not capture the relevant excitation that you want to describe. So that's the just breakdown. Just breakdown. Because this argument to consider Virasoro extending d/d5 is also rooted in the fact that you have this temperature. And if that argument breaks down, you have no motivation to really construct this phase space. Yes.
The supersymmetry extension on this solution?
Supersymmetric extension. So it's, yeah, you don't need supersymmetry for any of the arguments. Now, I don't know what supersymmetry will, probably if you embed, if you don't do gravity, you do supergravity, and then you want to say that the fermions also have some four dimensional symmetry, probably you will have a supersymmetry extension of the algebra. Right. I don't know what you would say.
These can't be supersymmetric in any theory.
Yeah. Ah, they can be supersymmetric.
Yeah, because they don't have a global time-like causal killing field.
Ah, okay.
So
okay.
Yeah. The killing field always goes space-like someplace, so it can't be the square of a killing spinner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Good. Yes.
When you say it extends to higher dimensions, you just mean that for every rotation plane, then you have a U1.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. So there is a question now that's come out, which is, and I don't know the precise. And I think I know the answer, but I cannot prove it. So the if you have these U1s, let me write it here. So if you go through that argument, you will find that there will be two temperatures. Let's discuss five dimension. So there will be T1, which will be 1 over 2 pi K1, and T2, 1 2 pi K2. And you can construct also a Virasoro extending the phi1 and another Virasoro extending the phi2. And if you play that game, defining a central charge just depends on the background and the theory. So you can define a central charge C1. And the central charge C2. So now what is at first sight very strange is that the entropy of the black hole is given by this quantity and given by this quantity. So it's not given by the sum of the two. It's given by each of them independently. And they are equal. The C1 is different than C2, but the product C1 CT is equal to the product C2 CT. T2. And it seems that there is only one way out of that, is that if you have this Virasoro, you have not constructed a consistent phase space. So you should still have defined a set of boundary condition of so that everything is consistent with all these requirements. And there is an argument, well, in that paper, Asegagi to Kawate Hoshima, that it's not possible to do so, to have a phase space that will contain at the same time the two Virasoro. And I don't know the details of that statement. What they say is that it's if it's true, then it would mean that there would be two different CFTs that would describe the system. And there would be two equivalent ways of describing the system. But there is no phase space that will contain the two Virasoro at the same time, the two excitation at the same time. Yes, it extends to higher dimensions as well. And there is even a claim in the literature that you can do even better than that because you have two angles. You have, in fact, a torus, and you can perform any SL2Z transformation to find new angles here and define new Virasoro algebra for each of them. So in place of having two CFTs, you in fact have a SL2Z family of them, and these would be you can explicitly construct the diffeomorphism associated to this SL2Z transformation, and they are large diffeomorphisms of this metric, well, in one higher dimension here. And the claim is that these diffeomorphisms will not preserve the boundary condition. They will map one set of boundary condition to another set, so they will map different description of the CFT. But these things are still to be cleared out. I don't see a very neat technical proof of that. Yes.
Does any of this care about the asymptotics of the solutions? Whether it's a sitter or anti-sitter, or is it?
No. So what really matters is the asymptotics of the near horizon geometry, which is always given by this. So
roots are in different places depending on those kinds of solutions. So you get the functional forms.
It's given by different functions C, B, and K. Okay. But that's all that matter in here. The geometry is still the near horizon of geometry of all these space time is still given by that form, but with different functions. And this function will appear in the definition of the area, for example. It would be just some integral of B and C. Right. So, something like that. Yes?
So, I'm a little confused. I mean, you wrote down this calculation where you have T1 and T2 and C1 and C2. Is the statement that you can write down a set of boundary conditions that gives you two Vera Soros, and so you get two central charges and two temperatures, and so Curtis' formula doesn't seem to apply, and so that there's secretly something wrong with that phase space, but it's not clear what that something wrong is?
Yes. Yes. So to define a consistent phase space, it's a lot of cross-checks of things that have to be done consistently, and there is no consistent set of boundary conditions in five dimensions that have been everything has been checked. I mean, if you want to write down some, there are some arguments that it's not possible. But I assume it's.
How did they get these central charges? For the
central charges, you can find them just so how they are defined. So for any theory, you can define the charges of your theory. So you can define let me tell you one thing maybe. How you define this thing. So you know Noether theorem says that for any global symmetry that you have, a conserved current. And this conserved current, J, is locally conserved, but you can write it with the Hodge dual as an n-1 form, where n is the dimension of your space. And so for each, in a theory with local gauge degree of freedom, you can say that any solution of that equation, any local symmetry, Killing symmetry, will be associated to a conserved n-2 form. And the central charge, in general, is given by the integral of this thing. This thing depends on it's a statement about solution linearized around, it's actually a statement, it depends on the linear solution. It's a bit technical. And the central charge is given by that quantity. Integrated. Oh, sorry. I see that. So, if you want to compute the Poisson bracket between the charge associated to a generator 1 and generator 2, the central term that will appear. So the algebra would be an isomorphism with the algebra of the exact symmetries, and the central term that will appear, which is this one, we call that K, is given by that expression, and that expression just depends on how you define this form K that you can define canonically for any Lagrangian, and the two generators, and define on the background geometry which is given by this one. And you have everything to compute that. You don't need to know what is if there is a phase space that admits that central charge to define it. You can compute that quantity. But now it's not clear if it exists a phase space such that all these quantities on the left-hand side exist? And I think it's a different question. All right. So maybe taught you a lot already. So I don't know if I want to say a lot more. Let me go to the conclusion. Yeah. So the conclusions are that so the main conclusion is this question mark. So from the three-dimensional perspective, if you have this Cardy formula always works, you have always it's always possible to write down the entropy of BTZ as a sum of these two square roots. And it doesn't imply that the theory can be quantized. It seems that it's very hard to quantize theory. So here also, in CurseCFT, you can do all the algebra, and you have a wonderful agreement, which is very well, which is non-trivial, because it's a lot of very different computation, and that they match. So the entropy each time can be reproduced by assuming there is something like a CFT with that temperature and that standard charge. But now it doesn't tell you if the theory is quantized or not. So to progress in that question, I think we should go back to 3D gravity, because in 3D we understand a bit how it works for ADS3, but far less is known for warp ADS3, where these warp ADS3 geometries are really the ones that appear here. And if one can understand everything in three dimension for these warp geometries, that would be a good start to try to understand KLCFT. So that's one point. And and the progress of trying to see if this chiral gravity really is quantized. Going to three dimension really helped to understand this KLCFT. It was the main point. And I finished.